gastrointestinal disorders. We open this lecture with the lovely topic of diarrhea. Okay, so what experiences have you had as a nurse with diarrhea so far? Any? Anybody had any Cody Brown experience? Please tell.
She was paraplegic, so every time we would roll her over, she had C. diff, so she had an infection. So she didn't really know she was going when she was going.
C. difficile, what is that? That's your C. diff. Yeah, what is it?
Posterior.
Moving on to diarrhea.
Yeah, something like that. Posterior difficile.
Okay. Good. We'll talk a little more about diarrhea when we move to talk about bowel problems. Diarrhea also often accompanies nausea and vomiting, right? If one has a whole flu bug going on. Now remember, nausea is stimulating the vomiting center in the brain. So is there always vomiting with nausea? No, right? Is nausea always a GI thing? No, correct? It can be an inner ear deal. Right? It could be emotional disturbance that causes nausea. So it's a stimulation of the vomiting center in the brain. Now, it's not at all uncommon for nausea to be followed by or accompanied with vomiting, which is coordinated by the brainstem. So anybody have any emesis experiences yet? Yes, tell us about your emesis
experience. Yeah, I did my patient with his... with his diagnosis, he was vomiting a lot and he had to give him PRNs. It was like he had some meds.
Antiemetics.
Yeah.
Would be the medications to stop him?
Yeah.
Good. And what was his diagnosis?
Acute pancreatic.
Pancreatitis.
Pancreatitis.
Pancreatitis. Pancreatitis, yeah. Gabby.
It was Amanda's patient. We had the same nurse, so we were kind of together. And, I mean, she can talk more about it, but all I saw, we were in the room together, and she took her medication, and she just, like, within 2 minutes, she threw everything up. And it was red, like, bright red.
Red?
Yeah. And then her and the nurse were talking about why it could possibly be red, and then they came to the conclusion that the medication that she had just took in and that she'd been previously taking is like bright red. And
right. So be careful of that. Thank you for bringing that up, Gabby. That's a really good point. Don't always assume you're looking at blood. Right? Because when there's emesis and it's blood, most of the time it's coffee grounds colored. It's dark. Why would that be? Any guesses? Why would it be dark instead of bright red like I'm assuming this was?
Mm-hmm.
Why would it be dark?
And that's kind of started to be digested in the stomach a little bit.
How about it's just old? It's like your scab, right? Blood, as it sits around, the color doesn't turn. Brown. So most of the time, when you get emesis, we talk about coffee ground emesis, and that's blood. So if you're seeing blood like Gabby was seeing, chances are it's not blood, which we're always concerned. It's the red jello they had earlier today, or it's the med, or something. So nausea is certainly something that we deal with quite a bit in vomiting. That's why they have those lovely little kidney basins that you can shove under someone's chin really fast. Okay? Sometimes people are vomiting too much for that. You have to get the whole big basin. It usually requires no treatment. Food is generally withheld. We like to give clear liquids, and our concern is dehydration. So somebody with a lot of nausea and vomiting would certainly be at risk for dehydration, and that would be a nice nursing diagnosis. We give antiemetic medications, okay? Emesis is vomit. So antiemetic are non-vomiting medications. And do we give them PO? Who had vomiting patients? Oh, someone was saying they were giving all the PRN. Yeah. Naomi, how were they given?
The
antiemetics.
Tablet.
They were given PO.
Yeah.
That's a bit unusual. Okay. Why would we often not choose PO? They're going to throw them right up again, right? Like you said.
Mm-hmm.
So what would be the best way to deliver an anti-medicine? IV would be excellent. There's one more opportunity.
Suppository?
Excellent, yeah. Again, if your patient has a fever and is vomiting, you might want to give the Tylenol suppository. Very often on your med list, you'll have a choice, not only of medications, but of delivery systems, how you deliver it. So if they're just feeling a little nauseous, you might want to give the antiemetic PO. That would be fine. If they're actively vomiting, probably not the best choice. Okay? And often we're given the same med in two, even three different compounds so that we can choose. Okay, are we going to give it IV, or are we going to give it PO, or are we going to give it Viracom? So think about that when you're dealing with people that are nausea and vomiting. And of course, complementary and alternative medications, ginger, right? Ginger is a well-known antiemetic, and there are many others that seem to work for people. Okay, so patho in the mouth, we can have problems. We can have stomatitis, infections of the mouth, and we can have oral cancer. In the esophagus, there's a few things I want to talk about. Esophageal reflux disease, what is that? We've all given medications for it. I bet the majority of your patients have been on something for GERD. Any ideas? What is GERD and why? Gastroesophageal reflux disease is basically heartburn. It's when stomach acids come up through the esophageal, we're missing you, up through the esophageal sphincter, and up into the esophagus. So patients get this burning kind of sensation. Generally, it occurs with age, certainly, but there are some other reasons, because of the sphincter is relaxed. So why are we giving them this to all our hospitalized, or the majority of our hospitalized patients? What puts them at risk for GERD? Any thoughts?
Because they're always laying down?
Yeah, no more complicated than that. They're lying down, you're eating lying down. What's that going to do? It can easily allow stomach acids to come up into the esophagus. There's some problems there, burnings of the tissue, of course. So what most of the medications do that fight GERD, and watch them, because if you know it, I'm sure the majority of you have written down your mentions, they're going to be antacids, right? We're going to neutralize the acids in the stomach so that when it comes up, it's not going to be detrimental to the esophageal tissue. Now, another problem we have along those lines is hiatal hernia. Hiatal hernia is when a portion of the stomach protrudes up above the diaphragm.
Okay.
Wow. Funny, but your book has some better pictures of it. Another issue that we may deal with. And it has a lot of the same symptoms as GERD. May, if it's painful, we may treat it. Often it goes non-treated. And there are esophageal cancers, of course. So here's a nice gastric reflux disease. It's this sphincter right here. Okay, and it just comes right up. We have the acids from the stomach going right up the esophagus. What about gastritis? I know gastritis is something that you've all experienced, right? Inflammation of the stomach, whether it be from a bacteria in that great Chinese food that you thought was wonderful. You know, or like my son who will eat anything in the fridge or his neighbor's fridge, and that's why he gets sick. I said, Patrick, you ate that chili? How long have you been there? He goes, oh yeah, it tastes a little weird. Well, yeah, it's been there for 2 weeks. I haven't gotten around to trying that. And there's some chili in our fridge right now that I better throw out. I'll still eat it. And then he'll be all nauseous and vomit the next day and not make his classes. Okay? So you got to smell stuff and look at stuff before you eat it. All right? So we've all had that, right? A little food poisoning. Not at all uncommon. The majority of gastritis is food poisoning. It's just a little bug that gets into your body. Shouldn't be there, colonizes and is happy. Hemoglobin, hematocrits, so you can all look at gastritis and all those things. Generally, community-based, meaning we handle it within the community. It's not hospitalized. Not a lot of treatment. Usually the gastritis runs its course. Here's a nice example of hiatal hernia. Here's the diaphragm. There's a bulging of stomach tissue up, and there's your esophagus. So here's the area that really doesn't belong there. This should be where the diaphragm line is. You can see, obviously, that's going to allow for a lot of gastric juices to reflex out. So anal hernia and GERD are very closely related. The symptoms are very similar. The difference being that the anal hernia would actually have tissue from the stomach protruding out of the stomach. But again, the acid can go away. Yes, ma'am?
Could you repeat the significance of hemoglobin in my blood cell
indices? Infection. That's all, basically, because you have an infection. So you're going to have something in the feed there. Okay, so how are we going to diagnose GERD or anal hernia? A barium swallow. Anybody have any experience with barium swallow? See that? It's a radiograph study where you actually swallow, the patient swallows some barium. It's often used in a swallow study when we're assessing someone's ability to swallow. It's often used to assess the structures of the GI tract. So you can see if there is a high opening, if there is a larger opening where people are experiencing GERD. Okay. We also do an upper endoscopy, which is a camera going down the throat. We monitor pH. Why would that be important?
For pH and the esophagus and the pH in your stomach should be different?
Absolutely. What are you going to get in the stomach?
More acidic.
More acidic, right. So if you're spotting a lot of acid higher in the intestinal tract, chances are there's a in the GI, in the esophagus. You probably have some good code. Okay, esophageal manometry is just another measurement of the esophagus and the sizes of the openings. This was my attempt to download a nice little diagram for you, and it didn't work, I'm sorry. So usually anal hernia doesn't require any treatment. It presents very much all good, as you can see. Physiologically, the same thing's going on, right? We're having reflux of gastric acid. At times, if the hernia becomes incarcerated, which means it completely closes off, then it can require surgery, but that is very rare. So we have some GI bleeding sometimes. Has anybody had a patient with a diagnosis of GI bleed? That's that same coffee ground. If someone has coffee ground emesis, your thought is going to be there's a GI bleed. There's got to be a GI bleed. Think about the anatomy. How else is blood going to get into the GI system? So what normally happens with a GI bleed, it's an ulcer or some kind of perforation. It may be a complete perforation. It may just be an ulcer, an erosion of tissue. It may be a peptic ulcer. Gastric problems are caused by too many NSAIDs, right? Aspirin, again. There's a reason why some medications are to be taken with food, because they can be damaging to the stomach lining. So that's why we coat them with food. And so in educating your patients on their medication regime, be sure that you pay attention to that. So generally, it leads to nausea and vomiting when there's this buildup of blood in the gastrointestinal tract. It comes up, right? It's too much. Yes, there are times when it passes in stools, and that's why we do what? What do you do to check for blood in stools? We learn abundant skills. Cold blood, right? Yeah. Because if you're going to be able to see that coffee ground looking stuff in the stool, it's going to be tough. We'll talk about that a little later when we talk about lower GI. But you certainly see it when it comes up. It's very obvious. It smells like blood. It looks like old blood. And it's coffee ground emesis. It's classic. So if someone is vomiting, someone says, oh, is it coffee ground emesis? You say, yes, you know. Okay, it's a GI bleed. That's it. We give medications for preventions of GI bleed. There are preventative measures. Obviously, keeping the acid low so there's no further erosion is important. It's accumulation of stimulated peristalsis. So there's more and more blood, it stimulates peristalsis, and then you get diarrhea, right? After bowel sounds, often vomiting, and that's it. Okay, what else have we got? GI bleed, stomach irritation, nausea, vomiting. You get black, tarry stools. And this again, the blood in the stools. So you get coffee ground emesis, and that same thing in stools are black, sometimes they're tarry. Sometimes they were even bloody, but in general, I made this mistake as a young nurse. I walked into the bathroom, a lady had just finished, and you know how when you put a drop of blood in water, it like looks like there's a ton of blood? So I'm looking in the toilet bowl, and I'm just, it's all bloody. Mm-hmm. So I'm frantic, I'm thinking, she has some major bleed, which is impossible because her color is fine and she's walking around. But I don't think that because I'm so inexperienced. I just think of all the blood in the toilet bowl, right, which is probably only about four drops, but because I wasn't all that familiar with the whole thing, it looked like a ton. So I say to the physician, who happens to be standing there, oh, it's got to be a GI bleed. She has all this blood in her stool. And he went, yeah, she has some hemorrhoids. Okay. So you're going to get red blood if it's hemorrhoids. Okay. You're going to get black tarry stools if it's... Because think about the anatomy. Hemorrhoids happen right outside the anus and just a little inside, right? So that's going to be frank red blood. And there isn't going to be a ton of it. But then remember again, when you put a little blood and water, it all looks like there's so much of it. So if you have black tarry stools, older blood, then that's indicative of a GI. Obviously, we're going to do a complete blood count. What would you expect the HNH to be when someone has a GI bleed? It's going to happen to the hemoglobin and hematocrit. Losing blood. Very simple. Absolutely. Often they need a transfusion. Very often that leads to a type of loss, which you all know is a blood test we need to do before we give blood. We may look at the electrolytes and see that they're off kilter, the osmolality, the BUN. Liver function studies, coagulation panels, upper endoscopies, all which would be part of a workup for a GI bleed to see exactly what's going on. What we do depends on the severity of the bleed. Okay. Massive bleeds, it could be surgically, need to be surgically stopped. Slow or chronic bleeds can be managed in a community-based setting, which just means at home. That is the more common, the slow or chronic bleed. We'll continue to give medications that will stop the acid. Gastric lavage, which means a little water.
Little water?
Water. It's normal saline in general. We go into the stomach, clean the area, and get up, and then we suction out the blood. Now, you've seen patients with nasogastric tubes, right? Okay. Are they always to put stuff in?
No.
This would be a case where we'd want it to take out, right? So if someone came into the hospital with a GI bleed, we might very well put down an NG tube. Would that be for feeding? No, that would be to remove the blood that's in there. In this case, we might very well also do a gastric lavage, right? Get some water down there, some saline, so that the blood would then be able to come up, rather than having to vomit and have all these other problems. So that's not uncommon. So when you see an NG tube particularly, don't assume it's for feeding. In fact, more likely an NG tube is not for feeding because if you use an NG tube for any length of time for feeding, we go ahead and put in a gastric tube. Okay, nasogastric tubes are temporary deals. And yeah, we use them for feeding, but also a lot for suction. For some reason, we want to suction out that stomach. And it's not at all uncommon that it's a GI bleed. Sometimes it's just a buildup of gas, and the stomach is just, the intestinal tract is paralyzed for some reason. Put down a GI tube just to release the pressure, an NG tube just to release the pressure. Yeah, got it.
My first patient had a GI bleed, but you're talking about like all the causes and stuff, and I don't really know what the cause of hers was.
Yeah, we don't always know. You know, it could have been an ulcer. It could have been just a lot of acid. It could have been perforation. Stress, because we build more stomach acid when we have stress. So it's going to be something that erodes the tissue and causes it to bleed. What that is, it's not real definitive. It depends on your patient.
Okay.
Could be some of the kinds of meds they're taking. Yeah. If they had a peptic ulcer. But for some things causing that tissue to bleed. Leading us right to peptic ulcers. Pain in the upper gastric region, heartburn, regurgitation, possible vomiting. Symptoms are a little less clear in the general population. Anybody have any experience with peptic ulcers? Any patients with them? Any personal experiences? Any moms, dads, sisters? sisters, brothers, cousins, ulcers. Ulcers used to be thought to be a disease of successful white executives, right? And then they would take milk and supposedly have to cut down on their alcohol. It's since been known that ulcers hit everybody, every race, every gender, every age. Any idea why it was thought to be white men? The thought was they have more stress than the rest of us. I think some kid that's being bullied in school is just as much stress as some executives. But that really was a thought in the 50s. A lot of the research, medical research that was done in the 50s was done on white men. So white men were looked at for heart attacks and heart problems. White men were looked at for ulcers. Everyone forgot it. The researchers really didn't survey the rest of us. So unless you're a white man, I guess you didn't get this disease. Well, we all do. A lot of the original data was with that population. Since we've gotten much smarter, and we know that peptic ulcers are caused by what? What causes peptic ulcers? H. pylori, bacteria. So bacterial by causation. So it doesn't matter how much milk you drink. You use some antibiotics. To diagnose them, you can use a barium swallow. See if there's an ulcer. Obviously, we can see the structures with the barium swallow, endoscopy again, some of these. This is an enzyme that shows when an ulcer is present. Antigens, okay. Urea breath tests, apparently there's more urea. And a gastric analysis, this syndrome also can cause ulcers. So here's a nice schematic. Here's normal gastric mucosa, okay, hanging out, looks good, right? No problem. All right. Now we have maybe some irritation. It could be from alcohol, aspirin, bile. There's some irritation in the intestinal mucosa for some reason. Aha, that leaves an opening for H. pylori to get in. And that is a bacteria that is pretty prevalent in our society, in our bodies. But anyway, it's allowed to colonize. Right? It can disturb the mucosal barrier. Gets it. And what do we get? Inflammation, right? Which is going to be our body's defense against any kind of bacterial invasion. The antigen comes in, we form antibodies, and the response of the body is inflammation. All right, then what happens? Erosion and ulcer formation. So that ulcer forms in the mucosa, and hence we have a peptic ulcer. There's our chronic ulcer. You can see there's erosion around it. It's not uncommon. There are also acute ulcers. They can come and go. Any and all of these can bleed. Yes, ma'am.
One of my friends had an ulcer in his stomach, and is it true that vinegar would help at all?
I've never heard that, and I can't think that it would because it's more acid. So, I mean, a lot of these kind of theories or customs do have some merit. I can't really think about why that would, unless somebody knows more than I do about the intricacies of the chemical content. It just seems that to add acid is a whole problem, so why would you add another acid? Yeah. Interesting. What else did your friend do? Did they take some antibiotics?
No? Not that I remember. It came out of nowhere because we were eating out at a restaurant or whatever. And then he just had to leave and go home because...
Low pain.
Yeah.
Was the vinegar maybe aggravating it? It could have been exacerbating it.
He didn't have any. And then he was like, oh, I just need to get something. Yeah. I don't know
what he's doing. But there are acute ulcers that kind of flare up and go back. Okay. And there are chronic ulcers that stay from. So we're going to give antibiotics, obviously, aren't we? We'll get rid of that H. pylori. We're also going to give antacids, right? Because we have all this acid floating around up here in the mucosa. That's not going to be very good for that horrible sore, right? You're going to get some blood from this, aren't you? So depending on where it is, you may see bloody stools or in the some illnesses.
Right.
Okay. So we do get medications, we discontinue NSAIDs, if it's NSAID-induced, can be. Encourage good nutrition, maybe surgery. Peptic ulcer. It's important for patients to discuss health promotion, obviously, because we do know that alcohol is a precursor for one. And certainly stress may be a factor in that when you are stressed, you create more stomach acids. So the chance of getting some erosion in that tissue and the availability for the H. pylori to colonize is great. So you should suggest measures to reduce the risks. Eat a more balanced diet, cut down on the alcohol. Try to live a less stressed life. Yes?
I don't know if it's just in Hispanic culture, but I know, like, I've heard that, like, a lot of chili and stuff like that, like, causes ulcers too.
Well, you know, that kind of makes sense, doesn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So I'm not sure.
I don't know if it actually causes, but certainly might make someone more prone. Right? Yeah, I think that makes all sorts of sense. Hot foods, right? Because
yeah.
what do we need first? We need that irritation of the tissue in order for the H. pylori to get into it. So hot foods and a lot of spices could certainly, I know that when I eat Indian food, which I really like, I absolutely have some irritation from all the spices I'm not necessarily used to. I think there's a good, one could make a good case for that. Any more comments on those ones? The stomitis, problems in the mouth. Usually people are greater than 65, there's some kind of immune status, HIV people, yeah, a lot. Chronic rheumatoid arthritis, heart failure, all these problems. Poor hygiene and tobacco and alcohol use can make someone prone. Esophageal cancer, we'll talk about these general cancer risks such as smoking, excess alcohol, this is what you see. Smoking opioids is a risk factor for esophageal. So is chronic GERD. That makes sense, right? Because you're disrupting the tissues. Peptic ulcers, old age, yes. Low social economic, sure. That kind of thing. Use of aspirin, yeah. Because aspirin is an acid, which makes me think that vinegar would not be good. History of ulcers, sure. Cigarette smoking, yeah. And some kind of history. Okay. That's upper GI. Now we get to move on to the lower GI, which is very exciting. Otherwise known as bowel, right? You read a little bit about C. diff in nursing students. You have a little bit more on C. diff, don't you? You see a lot of C. diff. And this is when we start with diarrhea. So who has had the privilege of a code brown so far? Yay, tell us about your code brown.
I did earlier. She was a paraplegic
every time. Oh, that's right.
Yeah, she pulled around.
You were from the morning, you were here in the afternoon, got it.
Yeah.
Any other code browns? What was, when you had that experience with that lady, were you alone? Who helped with all the
I was with my nurse.
Yeah.
And we just used a lot of the blue pads.
The checks.
Yeah, and just rolled it up and pushed it under.
Sounds like this nurse knew what she was doing.
Yeah. We had to clean her a lot. And it happened a lot when we did her catheter, get her rolling around, clean her first. And then I'm guessing rolling around just, I don't know,
you
have to go, I'm not sure.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
I'm sure it did. You see that a lot.
Yeah.
People, especially with paralysis, yeah, you move them and then just that added enough to the motility in the gut bit.
Yeah.
Sounds like this nurse knew what she was doing though, because what happens is she didn't have all those piles of pads under her. Then what would you be doing? You're changing the bed, right?
Yeah.
So as nurses, we get really good at finding diarrhea, people that have diarrhea. We put lots of pads, and then we just take another layer off, right?
And they had a good technique, because she had an air bed, they didn't have any sheets, so it's easy to wipe off, and then they put a chuck, like, over her, so she couldn't get on her gown, like,
and that's good
around
on top.
Her.
Yeah, poor lady.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but nurses get really good, so try to pick up some of those clues. Look, watch, if you can experience a code brown, it's really good. A lot of good techniques. Because sometimes, in nursing, we feel like, oh, we're doing this cleanup after diarrhea. Because if you have people with these chronic diarrhea episodes, sometimes that's all you feel like you're doing in the day. So I hope as students you have the opportunity to watch really skilled people work with that, because there are lots of tricks that you can employ. Anybody seen a rectal tube? Is that the same patient or? We seem to be doing more and more rectal tubes. So can you ladies tell us what it is? What's a rectal tube?
It was just a tube. It was pretty thick.
It is pretty thick, yeah.
Up the man's rectum, and when the nurse pulled it out, he still had stool, so he went in his anus and
did a digital removal.
Yeah.
Isn't that lovely? Yes, another little nursing job they didn't tell you much about before you sign up. Yeah. We're using more and more rectal tubes. I hadn't even heard of rectal tubes when I first started nursing. We're seeing more of them. They're great. They go into the rectum. Of course, they're uncomfortable and another invasive. He was big.
No, the tube.
Yeah, it's one tier, like a good inch plus in diameter.
Yeah, it was like this big. Yeah.
And then what did it go into?
Excuse me?
What did the tube, what was at the end of the tube?
I didn't see that part.
Ma'am, did you see?
The bag?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was it?
It was hanging on the...
It's like a Foley bag.
Yeah, it's like a Foley bag. It's on the side of the bed, but his was really, like, liquidy.
Yeah. We want to keep it liquidy when someone has a rectal tube, right? Or else it's not going to pass through the tube. So
we're trying to change it, but the whole floor didn't have another bag. So I don't know how much longer it stayed in there, like almost full. But
now, why would we opt for a rectal tube over diarrhea, or a rectal tube for diarrhea, but a tube for some of the diarrhea?
You don't have to clean it up.
Right, it doesn't take you hours and hours and hours of nursing time. Because that diarrhea, what's going to happen if it sits on the skin?
It's going to hurt
the
skin.
It's so erodes really quickly. It's amazing how fragile skin can just erode in a couple hours from sitting in diarrhea, especially if there's some acidic content. So it's something we're very, very aware of. Isn't this just a fun conversation? So you know what diarrhea is, the manifestations, and you know our care for it, right? Let's talk about constipation being the other side of the coin. We see a lot of it in the hospital, right? We give a lot of meds to stop it, don't we? Because what causes constipation in the hospital? What do we do to people that? What do we give up?
Medication,
yeah, what kind specifically? Opioids, yeah. Or painkillers, opioids specifically, yeah. But they're known to cause constipation. So your patient's uncomfortable, we start worrying. Oh, 3-4 days, depending on the patient, what's happened. If they've been to surgery and their intestines have been resting, maybe 10 days, depending on what's going on. So there's no hard and fast rule. But generally, someone who's having normal bowel movements, after about 3 or 4 days, you start getting concerned that there's some constipation going on. So again, the physicians have been very generous and allowed us to pretty much manage constipation. Isn't that great? We get pain and constipation. And so I know that every single one of you who have written a med list has written something for stool as a stool softener, right? There's not one of you who has. We generously give them. Now, when you wrote that, your stool softener, what is the side effect of a stool softener?
Diarrhea.
Diarrhea, right. So if you're the night nurse and you're noticing, oh, it's been 3 days, so you give your patient some of those PRN. And they're already on just 100 milligrams of Docalax a day. So you figure, well, this isn't good. You know, obviously this isn't enough. So you give him 250. Still nothing's happening in the morning. So he gets his 100. He's at the 250. You're the day nurse, and you're going, this still doesn't, nothing's happening still. So you give him some Maalox. Okay. So now he's got all these meds stacked. Finally, they all kick in. And what is that poor night nurse doing the rest of the night?
Cleaning
diarrhea, right? So when you give a stool softener, please look back and see what the nurses before you, like on the previous shift, have given, because sometimes they take 12 hours to work. And it's not a nice thing to do to your colleagues, to stack up all the stool softeners on them and then they have them all here once. It's pretty common. So diarrhea is very much an iatrogenic condition in the hospital. We cause it because we're trying to manage constipation. So just be aware, because it's completely nurse-guided. You're to a judgment on when to give them and when not to. So please be conservative. Take the time to look back and see what's being done. We talked about intervention. Irritable bowel syndrome. Anybody have any experience there? We're just going to kind of briefly review some of these more common GI problems, bowel problems. We're going to go into them in more depth next semester. Irritable bowel is chronic. It's a fairly young person's disease, more common in women. This is not a mechanical problem. It is a motility problem. So the bowel doesn't work real efficiently. Sometimes it will be sluggish, causing constipation. Other times it will be overactive, causing diarrhea, right? If you have too much motility, what's going to happen? You're going to have diarrhea. If you have too little, you're going to get constipation, right? Think about the peristalsis. So if there's a lot of movement, it's going to be diarrhea. Nothing can stay in. Versus a little bit, you're going to have constipation. And not a lot we can do for it, not in all actuality. Fecal incontinence, we talked about the rectal tubes.
Yeah.
Not only do we do it for, we usually do it for people with diarrhea who are incontinent of stool. For some reason, they've lost the control of that sphincter. These are the people that we're constantly working with, or that have rectal tubes. Again, this is just an example of acute inflammatory disorder, is appendicitis. You can be seeing some of that. Anybody? There must be someone with experience. There we go. Good. Tell us all about it.
Saw it.
Okay.
Yeah. I was sick for 3 months.
Oh, you had it? Okay.
Yeah.
Let's hear your story.
Huh?
Let's hear your story. Sick for 3 months.
Yeah, I was sick for 3 months. I was like handed to the doctor. They didn't know what it was. And they finally just decided to do exploratory surgery and found out that my appendix was inflamed from the bottom, with the under part of it.
Oh, so you had an unusual presentation.
Yeah. So it was bad. So then they took it out and I was fine right after. But I was in that pain for the longest time. I was on different types of medications and diets and stuff.
And they thought it was an ulcer probably at some point.
Yeah, they couldn't figure it out at all.
So appendicitis isn't always just a slam dunk, right?
Yeah.
Because you normally think, oh yeah, I come in obviously done. This is a teenager, a young person, it's going to be appendicitis. Well, they had to do exploratory surgery.
Mm-hmm.
That's so sad. I'm so sorry for you.
No, it's okay.
It's a simple thing. That's really too bad that the medical community took such time in finding it. Obviously, your brewery's point wasn't helpful because of where the inflammation was.
Well, it was crazy because they did so many tests. Like, I had ultrasounds, I had scans, and everything.
Couldn't
find it.
So it was hidden down.
Yeah.
So this wouldn't have shown anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Normally you can push right there. The rebound tenderness, meaning tenderness when you let go, and the tissue bounces back. That's that positive for peritonitis. What's that? Inflammation of the peritoneum. We see patients with that. We're very careful in surgery when we're working in the peritoneum to rinse the peritoneum with antibiotics. But there are times when there are bacteria, usually, that end up in the peritoneal cavity and can cause inflammation. So know that you may see that in your patients. Another way that could obviously is through a perforated ulcer. Or any kind of perforation from anywhere in the GI tract. We have a peritoneal inflammation, peritonitis. Gastritis. We've all had a little bit of gastritis at some point, haven't we? Gastroenteritis. Stomach and small intestine, gastroenteritis. Either our small intestine or our stomach has been a little irritated, right? Okay, we talked about that. We talked about the manifestations, complications. But they're also, it might not just be the crummy food that my son took out of the chili, you know, from 2 weeks ago. There are also other problems, such as a protozoan invasion, an amoeba, okay? This is a fungal infection, you can get worms, all right? So be really careful when people have diarrhea or vomiting. You really don't know what kind of bug they're expelling from their bodies. So I suggest you do be very careful with your gloves and your and all. You can tell a lot from the diarrhea too. Is it a lot of water? So what are you looking at? So that might be important too. For instance, my patient, remember he is on TPN, right? So we're completely resting the GI tract. He's lost control of his bowels. His diarrhea is like, it's like mucus, but it's clear. It's like clear jello, like gelatin with no flavoring in it. The oddest diarrhea I've ever seen. And actually that makes sense, doesn't it? Because we're not using his GI tract at all. So there's not, his GI tract is sterile. So we're not, we don't have any of this stuff. There's no food, there's nothing going down him but a little water. We get him some water. Okay. So we have this mucus clear jello stuff. It's very interesting. I've never seen it. And it's most unusual because people aren't generally on TPN as long as he is. It's kind of interesting. So diarrhea comes in all sorts of different, presents differently. And it's important to take a look and see. It could be, you have to figure out the pathologies behind it. Ulcerative colitis, Crohn's, we talked about. Crohn's, ulcerative colitis. Okay, again, diseases that cause ulcers in the intestinal tract that can lead to GI bleeds, right? Can be a differential diagnosis for peptic ulcers. Crohn's is autoimmune. It's all, and you'll learn more about it next semester. It causes erosion in the GI, just so you know. That's what's going on. Okay, this is some more infected GI, this is Crohn's, more about that, obstruction, diarrhea, oh yeah, diverticular disease. And your patients have diverticulitis? You know what a diverticula is? The little small section of the colon that goes out like this, and it balloons out, so the colon's coming down, and you have a little blip. Pretty common among the geriatric population. So if you're thinking you've got this nice tube, right, that everything runs down, everything's good, now it's got a little blip in it. Okay, or a little outpouching. What can happen with that, do you think? Things can get caught in it, right? Great. So then that sets up a nice area for bacteria to grow. And then you get diverticulitis with the inflammation. Okay? And that can go on to peritonitis, abscess formation, bowel obstruction, fistula. It can grow, it can get big, it can clog the whole GI tract. It can rupture, cause peritonitis. So be really aware of inflammatory disorders such as diverticular disease. Keep your eyes open, it's pretty common. Ask your grandmothers. Alright? They'll be well aware of it. I think I have some pictures. Here we go. There's a diverticula. See, they're just kind of hanging out there. Yes, Gabby.
Do they only cause the problem once they become inflamed?
Yes.
The ones that are those?
They're fine. They can just sit there and live. It's fine. But you always have the possibility when you have them of some inflammation. And they used to tell people like not to eat seeds and that kind of thing, thinking that small strawberry seeds would get stuck in. I don't know, there's been some recent literature that kind of says, nah, it's not real true, but you still very well may see the education for people with diverticulitis not to eat seedy things or poppy seeds, things that can get stuck and stay in those little crevices that have developed in the intestine. Diverticula. So diverticula themselves are not a problem, right? It's when they become inflamed. And they always have the potential. Yes.
They said that for me, for appendicitis as well, like not to eat stuff like that.
Did they?
Because it's the same concept.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you'll hear that. There's some literature that disputes that right now, but we'll see. I'm sure that theory is still well adopted, not to eat little seeds and stuff. So you're not eating seeds?
No, I don't have to.
No problem. Okay. Neoplastic disorder is talking about cancerous growth. We talked about cancer last time. The bowel wall, protruding into the lumen, cancerous growths are not at all common in this area. Start out as polyps. There you go, there's a tubular polyp. Okay, some more polyps in the intestine. And colorectal cancer is the third most diagnosed cancer in the U.S. But you can do colostomy. You can look at them, right? You can do scopes and see if they're there. So if you maybe after 50, you should have that. An exam to see. Colorectal cancer, type 1 cancer last time. Lot are in the rectum, okay, colorectal, the most common. So those are the percentages of where you see colon cancer. Mostly colorectal, which is why so many colostomies. Let's see, so we talked about hernias, right? Also, you can have hernias that go inward in the intestinal tract that cause obstructions. So be aware of that. They can poop out of the abdominal cavity. It can cause obstructions. So just know that obstructive hernias. There we go. There's an inguinal hernia, the abdominal wall, in different places that it's not uncommon to have hernias. We talked about hiatal hernia in the diaphragm. Inguinal hernias are common. Just a little aside, because that's not really intestines. What else? We have obstructive disorders. So it can certainly be caused by constipation. Extreme constipation can be an obstruction. It can also be a growth, a cancer, right? Failure of the intestine to move, intestinal content to move through the bowel movement would be an intestinal obstruction. So you can get cramping, pain, vomiting, electrolyte imbalance, large bowel reconstipation. And this is a little tricky because someone may say, well, I've had diarrhea for months. How could I possibly have a reconstipated? Well, because the diarrhea can come around the hard piece of stool that's still sitting there. So that's, it doesn't necessarily mean that people have been completely without a bowel movement. So you'll see some of this. Intestinal obstructions are extremely common. Small bowel, large bowel, it can be as bad as going into gangrene if it gets really serious. There's all sorts of different obstructions, things that can happen. The intestines can actually wrap around each other, volvulus. German shepherds get this. They're serious, and they usually die. Yeah, volvulus, but people can have it too. There was a gentleman last semester at Marine General that had it. You can have an intestine that is intussusception. Where it kind of comes in on it on itself, where the tube kind of folds in. That's this. You can have all sorts of mechanical adhesions, right? Gross scar tissue that can then become obstructive. You can have an incarcerated hernia, this kind of thing, where you can have tumors. Very common obstructive problems with the GI tract. You learned about colectomies, surgical resections, and you know about pouch and how to handle that. You learn that skills, right? Hopefully you'll have an opportunity to work with that. Again, the lovely nursing project. Okay, so here we go. We just sew up the, okay, and divert it out. Let's see, where's another, I have a better picture. It's coming. There. Okay. That would be a double barrel colostomy. There's the levels of the colostomy. We have them coming out. We cut at all these points, basically. Okay. Now, an ileostomy, what, is going to be higher, correct? Mm-hmm. So if you have some people have an ileostomy and a colostomy. Interesting. Small intestine, and later they have one of the larger ones. If you have an ileostomy, how's that going to differ from a colostomy in what you see excreted? What do you think?
Ileostomy is like wet, right?
Wet, water, more water. And why would that be?
Because it's higher and it hasn't formed.
It's higher and it hasn't had a chance for the water to absorb. So yes, absolutely, absolutely. It still hasn't formed because the absorption takes place lower in the intestine, right? So if it's higher in the intestine, you get a lot more fluid. So you're going to be able to tell just from the contents of the ostomy how high it is. The ostomy is pretty high. The small intestine. And you all saw these pictures when you had skills, right? I hope you all have the opportunity to care for an ostomy. There's a nice picture. See along this guy. Perianal surgery, we had our ring of fire guy who's having hemorrhoidectomy, right? We also have sphincterectomies. Problems with the sphincter. So I'll let you take your break and monitoring GarageBand. I have a little project that you can do with your break, before your break, during your break. Stop you.